Welcome back to Critical Moves, everyone, and the continuation of our interview from last week, Arkane Games CEO Chris McElligott-Park. If you're just joining us, please jump back to the previous episode, number 42, to see what you missed out on. Right, so it sounds like you kind of started out by wanting to make a PvP game to play with your family, and over time started to introduce the mechanics of the AI, and at that point, would you say that you basically developed the narrative after that point to fit the premise of your gameplay loop?
I would say the narrative part came about when I realized that I needed to be a magician and not create a, you know, because that was the tipping point in March 2009. I was like, a human stand-in is never going to be enough. I developed the PvP part only for testing purposes, you know, because I wanted to make sure it mechanically felt good, and I wanted to see the sort of thing, what hijinks would we get up to, right? And therefore, what was mechanically sound, right? But then at that point, I was just like, okay, so this needs to be different. Like, the mechanics are good, but like, we're bored of playing PvP against each other. That was never our intent to do in the first place. The intent was always to grow to PvE. But if we just linearly went from here to PvE, it would just be what we're doing now, but against someone stupider. And so it was like, all right, what would an interesting foe look like? And okay, I want to feel like Ender Wiggin. There's got to be a lot of them, that means. And there's four of us. We're playing four on essentially one. So we need to be in the minority, even though there's four of us. So why not fill everything? Why not? Because it's like, you know, scouting is always interesting, but it's really boring when so much of the map's just empty, right? And if you got a giant map in Supreme Commander 1 and half of it is just like empty desert that nobody's in, I mean, okay, it increases travel times. That can be useful, but it's not that interesting, really. It just means things are further away. So I was like, all right, well, what if the map's actually like full of stuff and it's like different at the different places? So what would this be? It was like, all right, well, I, you know, only have but so much art here to work with. So it should be an artificial intelligence. I mean, I like artificial intelligences anyway. And that way it kind of makes sense why they've got some of the same gear that we do. And some different gear too, but why there's commonalities. Not like, oh, we're going to have, you know, like completely different, like alien visuals or something. I mean, into the expansions got into that. But, you know, I didn't have a budget to like hire an artist at the early stage. It's like, all right, well, why would humans be acting that way? And why are we fighting each other? And, you know, why don't they just bum rush us when they notice? Like, that's, that doesn't really hold together narratively, right? Like, you know, if you attack one city in a country, then that whole country is like after you immediately. And, you know, it seems kind of far-fetched that they wouldn't just react and crush you instantly. So it's like, what's a plausible reason they wouldn't? I'm like, well, if they're artificial intelligence and they're kind of on station keeping duty, and it's like, well, that other planet's not my problem. You know, like they think really differently. And so, like, all right, well, let's lean into that and flesh that out, so that this passes some suspension of disbelief for the players. And then let's make it so they have all these subcomponents that exist for you to be able to exploit them in interesting ways, you know. And that's when the narrative really started kicking off, because it's like, all right, well, how can we grow the narrative in terms of like what would be mechanically interesting? Both my dad and my uncle are huge sci-fi nerds, and I grew up around that, and they have a huge knowledge of 50s to 70, well, and onward, really, 50 to 70 sci-fi that I don't really have at that level. I'm further on, you know, 80s on, more so. And so there were a lot of things where they would be like, no, that stretches my disbelief too much. She's like, all right, well, would you believe it if it was this? And so we workshop through things. We're like, oh, this works, you know. And so, so that was a, you know, does it pass the BS test of like, yeah, that sounds reasonable, and then just kind of building up. So there's, you know, in terms of actual story for that game, like, there's like an opening crawl that had like 20 sentences or something. It's very short. And, then everything else was just kind of world building in the units and how they behaved and like little journal entries about the units and, flavor text on, some of the different like depots and things, other buildings and like, you know, space buildings, that you could, you know, exploit and so forth. And, things grew up from there because it was like, all right, well, what's going to be interesting and what doesn't make us like roll our eyes out of our head in terms of, oh, that's, yeah, sure, it does that. Yeah. Huh? Or this is the stupidest AI I've ever heard of. Like, why doesn't it just crush us? Like that needed to be plausible. So everything needed to go to reinforcing. Why is it plausible that we can be Rambo in the forest and they don't send out the Marines? Like, you know what I mean? Like Rambo in First Blood, he's like, you know, they had telephone issues back then, right? And it was kind of like, well, okay, the main AI is not here. They're not home. They have telephone issues. They're outside the galaxy fighting something else in intergalactic space, and they're trying to devote a minimum of resources to here, and their subordinates are not nearly as smart as they are. And the more you piss them off, the more they send more and reinforcements from the main war. You are the sideshow. They are just trying to deal with something more on their level and send minimal, you know, they don't really realize how threatening you are until the last second. And if they realize too soon, then you're dead. And that was an interesting dynamic there too, because people believe that, right? You know, oh yeah, much bigger foe than me has big problems elsewhere. I buy that, sure. And they're, you know, they have stupid subordinates. Yeah, that happens. Bureaucracy, I get it. You know, and then it's like, you know, and they're shipping in more stuff because of my reactions. Like they are reacting to me. They're not, you know, they didn't send the whole Marine straight to my house, but they're reacting. And, you know, they're underestimating me. And that feels both good and bad to the player in a very delicious way. Because on the one hand, it's insulting, right? You know, they don't even take me seriously. I'll show them, you know. And then when you win, of course, you're vindicated. So that feels good. But then also there's the other side of it of, ha, they don't take me serious. Look at me creeping around in the bushes here, bushes of space, you know, and I look what I'm doing. I'm so smart. They're not even going to realize until it's too late. Ha, you know, and so there's this, it very much fulfills a fantasy in a very ludonarrative, coherent way, right? And so you really have to backfill from, what is going to be the interesting gameplay? And then what is going to make that sound reasonable? And there's how you get your world. There are times where I will start with pre-existing conditions to a world. Like, oh, this is generally, like, this is set in the same universe, so these certain things are true. You know what I mean? But you still have a lot of room where you have to kind of reverse engineer. Okay, this is the gameplay I want. How do I make that happen with fitting with the existing world lore plus new stuff I'm going to make up, you know? As needed, right? So the but a lot of it, like the vibe comes first, you know, because there's a lot of different ways to get the same sort of vibe, and you know, want to feel like Rambo, or and Ender Wigan. I didn't really want to feel like Rambo, but once it came out, it was like, you know, this is kind of, you know, what's happening, and that's really fun.
It's quite Borg-esque, isn't it?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. The way you've described that was just that was just the Borg to me, where Starfleet can go to a cube, and as long as they're not perceived as threatening, they're left alone.
Yes. I always, the Borg were some of my favorite arcs in the Next Generation, and Undoubtedly, that was an influence. Like, the idea that a giant, massive, scary spaceship would not attack you is so much scarier than, like, the one that does.
Yeah, it's the suspense, isn't it? It's brilliant.
Yeah. Yeah. And so it's just like, you know, there's some implicit, there's some implicit insult in that. And by having some voice lines in there for when players would do certain things, like if they took a planet or got a certain sort of depot or whatever, there were these certain line banks that we would do. And it would be like, oh, you think that matters, you know, or you really, or if the AI would like trash you, because you could kind of tell if that happened, or you really thought that would work, you know, stuff like that. It doesn't take much. Our brains are natural storytellers. And so it's kind of like, you know, you've probably seen the memes of like Mario Kart 7, and like whenever Luigi passes you, for whatever reason, they animated him so that he gives you this glare. And people's, I mean, one, that's just funny. But two, people's brains fill stuff in. So if you shot Luigi with a green shell and then you pass him, and then later somebody hits you, and maybe it was Luigi, but then he passes you and goes, wahoo, and is glaring at you as he goes, our brains fill in. He remembers what we did to him. He's angry, and he got revenge, and now he's satisfied. None of that is in Luigi's code. That's all in your head. But it makes a cohesive story for the player. And if you read, like, I've been super obsessed with Boat Murdered, the Let's Play from Dwarf Fortress, ever since I read that. And you can totally see that sort of thinking, because Dwarf Fortress from back then and now as well gives you a lot of detail, but it's still not enough to be like, it's not like ultra high fidelity. Like, for instance, if you're playing The Last of Us or something, there's no mistaking what's happening on the screen. There's no like, wow, I don't understand the pixel art in front of me. I wonder what's happening. And it's like, no, that dude just got shot, or that person just demoted, or whatever. Like, it's really, really clear. And that's very cinematic, but it leaves no room for like creating an extra narrative in your head, because you feel like you are looking at kind of photorealistic-ish humans, and you understand what their emotions are. When you're looking at something more abstract, Dwarf Fortress, any sort of pixel art game, whatever, our brains start filling things in. And even with something like Mario Kart, that's more abstract because nobody talks except for their little barks, wahoo, or whatever, as they pass you, right? And so when those barks play, those are actually really key to reinforcing what happened. Because when you hit Luigi the first time, he went, wah! So you remember the audio, that was who I got. Then he made a different noise when he got you back. That audio, if you didn't have the audio part, it was just visuals, you wouldn't necessarily make the connection. But because those two audio cues are there, it ties it together in your brain, and you're like, this whole story just snaps into place. And so I intentionally do that. And here's the funny thing. You can tell someone to their face, hey, I'm about to manipulate your emotions. There's no connecting wire here. It's not reacting emotionally at all. Then you play them the audio cues. They have all this sort of stuff. They fall for it. I fall for it with my own AI. Our brains are wired to fall for it because our brains are natural storytellers. We can't not fall for it. And so I take advantage of that a lot, because when it's something like if we've got an opponent, you and I are facing off in some fashion. You make a mistake. What do I think? I think you made a mistake, or you're luring me into a clever trap. I don't know. If I just see the mistake, I think you made a mistake. If then it turns out you have a secondary force and you obliterate me, I'm going to interpret that as maybe that mistake was on purpose and you caught me in a trap. There's no way for me to really know without asking you, and you can either tell the truth or lie. It doesn't really matter. If I can't ask you, I'm going to probably default to thinking you're very smart. And so a lot of times, and so you know, an AI opponent can do like 10 dumb things and then one thing that seems really smart, and the players will remember the one really smart thing and they will overlook the dumb things as either being, those were probing missions, or, oh, those were a setup for the smart thing, or those were just diversions or whatever, right? They'll make up whatever. It doesn't really matter. And it becomes richer in their head because of that extra level of abstraction, which you don't have in, say, chess, because of the huge opportunity cost in chess. You get one move every turn. That's it. And so there's no, like, faking it out. And then, you know what I mean? Like, at any level of real skill, there's no, like, oh, they were playing bad on purpose and then got me. Like, that doesn't really happen in chess. But when there's low opportunity cost, in other words, you've got thousands of agents doing hundreds of things at any given time in groups of various sizes, then 9 out of 10 times they can do something semi or moderately stupid. And the one time they do something really smart is the one that the players will remember. And so, and first person shooters, squad based games, especially ones like Far Cry, which was certainly an influence on my thinking about AI, really lean into this as well, because they've got such a low opportunity cost per like squad of guys versus something like Counter-Strike, which is something actually like modded AIs for, has a much higher opportunity cost because once you're dead, you're dead, and there's only so many guys on the team. So it's really hard to make a smart Counter-Strike AI compared to the squad AI in Far Cry has an inherent advantage over that, you know, and it's similar concept in really any genre. But yeah, you can tell I look at a lot of other genres for inspiration because I am just going to wind up repeating other people if I look at strategy games. So I will look at strategy games, but they're not my... When I'm looking for inspiration for another title, I don't look at other strategy games. I look at other genres, or I look at board games. Like Scythe was a big impact. It's a 4X board game, and it was a big influence on Heart of the Machine. And, you know, one of many. But constraints that they're under are very different from the constraints that a computer game is under, even though they're both strategy games. So they had to get creative in some interesting ways. I was like, oh, those are some clever ideas. I can use those in a different context. And
yeah, from a world building point of view, I'm so intrigued by the implication that the AI is dealing with something outside the galaxy. And that's why, you know, like it, to explain how you could even survive, how Rambo comes to be in the woods, that the AI is dealing with something that's so, like, it's so immediately captivating for me. But I'm going to pivot to a history of this industry that I love so much, which are these little pockets of like Wild West, where in the 90s it was like, you know, Oddworld, and it was Doom, and these college kids coming together to make these games. And in your case, you brought up something I think I've brought up on the podcast before, which is like they kind of called it the indie apocalypse at the time. That late 2000s Fez, Thomas Was Alone by Mike Bithell, popping up on Steam whenever there were no other games on Steam from indie developers. And you talked about how lucky you were to kind of get AI War up on there.
Yeah, I don't know. That's like the silver age of indies, I think, maybe. You know, there's like, I don't know, like if there was a golden age, it would have been like Cave Story and Geometry Wars and stuff in the 2000s. And there was kind of like the silver age of stuff where in 2000, you know, World of Goo would have been golden age, you know, as well. And then it was like in Braid. And then it was like, yeah, Fez and my stuff and a bunch of other titles from like 2009 to, you know, Minecraft, certainly Silver Age as well. All of that through about 2014 or so, you know, and then it was like 2015 or thereabouts was the indie apocalypse when kind of the Silver Age ended and it was time for a new thing. Yeah, I'm using like comic terms now. Now we switched industries again. But, you know, that's kind of how I think about it. And, you know, it's like prehistory with the 90s, which, you know, I loved that shareware time period and stuff. And In the 80s, it's kind of an aside. In the 80s, for the Atari, there was kind of a similar thing. It's just way fewer people partook in that. And it was more of an American thing than international. And like in France, there was, you know, a different similar situation going on. But basically, it's like, you know, my dad worked at a telecom company. And so there were like games that random people would just cook up at a telecom company or a technology company, and they weren't looking to get paid for it. It was just, they then would pass it around on floppy disks, right? And 5 1/4 inch ones, right? And those would come home. And so we had all these floppy disks of things that weren't commercial products. They were just things that some programmer at some tech company made and then passed around, and other people kept passing it around. Nobody was trying to sell it. It was just, here's the thing. And some of them were the sort of thing that you could play with for like, you know, 20 minutes. You're like, that's interesting. That's weird. And it's very difficult. Well, this is interesting, you know? And then you like come, you know, and they're like, oh, play that every few months for like 20 minutes at a time. You know, it's like that small, but it were not things you would see elsewhere. And then there were ones that were bigger. And everybody obviously remembers like, well, Rogue, certainly, because roguelikes, but, Adventure was arguably even larger, at least in the time period that I'm talking about. It was another, it was kind of like Rogue, but it, I think it was first, honestly. So, you know, you have these different time periods where people are sharing ideas in different ways, and people freely... Like, I want people to copy my ideas. I'm not running short on ideas. Somebody wants to take inspiration from AI War and make a game, I'm all for it. That's not going to hurt me in any way. You know, in the same sort of way that's like everything was called Doom clones for a little while, right, in the 90s. And it's like, okay, that's reductive. First-person shooter, apparently. You know, and it's like, oh, well, what about Thief? Like, it's not really shooting or... You know, but it's first person. It's like, well, I don't know. That's an immersive sim, but it's first person. So it's an FPS, I guess. I don't know. But I've never heard of like somebody who works on an M sim being like, nobody else better make any M sims because, you know, I invented M sims and I don't want anybody else to do it. The reality is that when you make a game, usually you don't get to enjoy it like everyone else did because you know too much right from the start. So if you were the first person who invented Doom clone, you made some innovation, whatever, originated a genre, whatever, and then someone else does something new, whether they improve upon it much or not, it's really interesting because now you get to play too. So, you know, I cannot imagine I don't know John Romero at all, but I cannot imagine him being like upset per se by the other titles. Like, he may have wanted to keep the, you know, he was very kind of a competitive guy, don't get me wrong, but it wasn't like he was, I bet he enjoyed playing his competitors' products. Yeah, and I certainly know that John Carmack did. Not that I know him either, but he's been very like clear about it versus John Romero has been a little more hostile. And I think if you look at any kind of generation of developers, you're going to see the same sort of thing.
It's the highest form of flattery.
It really is. Yeah, Starduck made a game that they mentioned AI War Fleet Command as one of their three influences. I think it was Fallen Enchantress or something. And I was like, dang, that's, thank you. Like, you know, and then it really didn't do well. And I was like, oh man, like I was rooting for that one. Like, because I really wanted that one to succeed because I felt like it had some of my DNA in it. You know what I mean? And then it didn't. And I was like, man, I hope that wasn't because of the part of my ideas. Like, you know, like I didn't have anything to do with that project, but I still felt like a little bit, like a grandfather or something, you know? So, you know, it is absolutely the highest form of flattery.
I also want to say, first of all, on the Arkane Games website, I am a huge fan of every website I go on. As somebody who loves to read those stories like that, your about page, everything is exactly how I try to do it on my personal website as well for albums and things like that. Something I thought was really interesting as I read through the history of your games was your interactions with John Bain, Total Biscuit, the YouTube commentator and reviewer. To help establish the story for our listeners, one of my favorite games of all time is a game called Warframe that released into early beta in 2013, I believe, on Steam. They had gone to most of the major publishers in the world and had been turned away, being told that their project would fail and that it was unpublishable. So they decided to self-publish, and the game released in a very small state where they had to have laid off most of their staff to get the game out at that point. And they had very few players and a number of founder packs and very poor gameplay. Ultimately, the point of this is that Total Biscuit released a video titled WTF is Warframe in 2013 or 14, I believe. And because he had sent his audience their way with a positive review, Warframe was able to hire on additional staff and release more updates with the purchase of founder packs. And they're now one of the largest multiplayer games on every platform. So that just kind of goes to show our listeners who are uninitiated to that Total Biscuit has been largely credited with the success of early Warframe in that way, and similarly to a bunch of other indie titles. And I thought I just saw in the about page where you had mentioned that you had either had interactions with Total Biscuit or he had kind of contributed in some way to the early marketing of AI War. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah. John and I were not friends, I should say. And that is because of his professionalism. For context, one added piece of context, John passed away from cancer in, I think it was 2016 or something along those lines. Prior to that, for the youngins around here, he was the number one PC games critic, and by a large margin. And also, for context, for younger viewers, influencers didn't really matter back then, except he did. And there were a few others, but it was not like, so there's not a comparison I can really make for anything like that. Back in, so for kind of a contrasting story, because I think it's relevant, the two main gaming adjacent, press isn't quite right, but press or influencer figures that were big in my early career, Tom Chick and John Bain. And so Thomas, who put me on the map originally, he was writing for Crispy Gamer at the time, which is a magazine that no longer exists. And later he was the guy who ran like the Sci-Fi Channel's reviews and their blog and stuff like that. That was the first like really big review. And it was one of the things that got me noticed by other, Alec Meir, then, you know, was another one that wrote a big review for PC Gamer after that. That kind of put AI War on the map. And it was because of like those ones that was able to jump to full time. That got us like more exposure with like Eurogamer and other bigger outlets that wouldn't normally cover, you know, deign to cover an indie game. And so like AI War, the first one was the 40th best reviewed indie game of 2009, which is it was the 40th best reviewed PC game of 2009. So that includes indies and AAAs and AAs. That was a really big accomplishment, and it's not something I've ever, you know, been able to repeat. And the context of the world now means that it wouldn't mean the same thing anyway. Back then, it was just incredibly unlikely. Tom, you know, made no secret of the fact that he was a fan of my work. And, you know, he had a podcast and I was on his podcast several times. We became quite friendly. He did a little bit of contract work with me for one game where I, you know, wanted him to consult on something. It was to do with the name of game, because when I released the game Bionic Dudes in 2013, he was like, Chris, this is the worst name for a game. You can't put such negative words in the title. It turns people off. They're not going to click in. How's your click-through rate? I'm like, it's lower than it normally would be. And he's like, yes, it's because of the name. I was like, all right. And so I had gotten him to contribute there. So that's a kind of contrasting thing. And he was more kind of mainstream press, right? By contrast, John was nobody in 2009. He did he was like an esports commentator back then. And I was not in the esports scene at all. And he was like mildly to moderately well known there. But, you know, he was starting to kind of grow his audience more and stuff. And I mentioned earlier that like the second title we did was a puzzle game and that did not go well. And I was in late 2010. And, you know, I made the fact that that was happening known. And I posted about it. And then there was this big outpouring of support from a bunch of different people. And I got this one email from somebody I'd never heard of, saying, hey, I heard the news that, you know, Arkanen is in trouble and you guys are doing, you know, really interesting stuff that nobody else does. That is not okay with me. What can I do to help? And I was like, damn, that is incredibly touching. Who is this person? You know, and that was John Bain. And, you know, he went by both Total Biscuit and Total Halibut. And I think he had a third name earlier on in, but, his audience was modest at that point. Like he was definitely a signal booster. Don't get me wrong, but it wasn't life-changing like it was for the Warframe thing. He was still on his way up. In 2014, would have been May of 2014. He had the whole WTF is series. And so he did one for The Last Federation. Now, this is why I said he and I were not friends. I would have loved to be his friend. And I think he would have liked to be my friend as well. And we actually, weirdly, he moved after a while and we lived within like a couple hours of each other. We never once met up. And we exchanged occasional emails and so forth, but because being an influencer, like being an indie developer early on in there, was not really a respectable job, that which I know is hard to understand now, right? Like games journalism was the respectable job. So Tom Chick inherently had respect and he was part of various establishments. And so he and I could be friends and it wasn't a problem, right? Because he was a journalist. But John and I, that would be like, he couldn't speak impartially about my work anymore if we became friends, and he wanted to do that. And I respected that. So I would always send him a key, you know, personally to anything new that I was doing. And if it was up his alley, then he would maybe do something. And I would often hear back from either him or his wife, Gemma. But it was not like, it was very distant because he was trying to model the consummate professional, which he was. And I always really respected that. And I felt like the struggle of early YouTubers and influencers in general in that way can really be seen in how he had to behave versus how Tom was able to behave, right? And because it would have been really fun to hang out. But at any rate, when The Last Federation came out, not only did he do a WTF is video, which that was probably the only time in the early, in the 2010s or before, where I saw like a visible spike after somebody covered a thing like Eurogamer or IGN or something could cover your game. And yeah, that covers, that helps with like general like inflow of people over time. But it's not like a bunch of people just suddenly show up. John would make a WTF video, and if it was like at all positive, then like people started showing up. And in June of that year, I didn't even know this because he didn't tell me. I found out like a month later, somebody's like, hey, have you seen this other video? I'm like, what video? What are you talking about? And they're like, they made an animated video about your game, two of them. I'm like, what? You know, and so they'd done this thing called the Biscuit Federation, which it was a, they had the co-optional podcast, and they, that was just a thing where they talked, and he was telling about a 5-minute story about his experiences playing the game. And it was really funny. And they decided to animate that, and they did it as a 2-part animated thing. And I was like, this is my boat murdered moment, because so much of what this is someone else retelling their experience in my game. And that's the whole thing with Boat Murdered, right? If there are people who were telling the story about their adventures in Dwarf Fortress weren't so funny and so good at storytelling, Boat Murdered wouldn't be very interesting. There are a lot of other Let's Plays from Dwarf Fortress. I don't personally find any of them interesting, but Boat Murdered, man, that tickles my fancy. This was my Boat Murdered moment here, where he's like, you know, so I committed genocide and I won the game. And it was so effective that they just had to patch that out. And I was like, no, that's the one thing you said that was wrong. I didn't patch it out. I just made the other races find it horrifying. That's all. You know, and so like the good races would like break off and so forth. Cause he'd been like dumping toxic waste on there. And I saw that the video has been, taken down in the last year, and I don't know why that is. A lot of the co-optional podcast videos got taken down, and I keep meaning to write to Jenna and say, hey, like, that means a lot to me. Like, can that go back up? Because that was just like a career highlight for me. And the last Federation was Arkane's fastest selling game ever, and I do think that had a lot to do with Total Biscuit, you know, John. And he was a stabilizing factor in the early 2010s for me. Someone I really admired and would have liked to have been friends with, but I understood why we couldn't be. And that in itself was interesting as well. So it was, man, he's really a really, really sharp guy. I miss the fact that he's not around anymore.
Right. And I want to emphasize too, right, that we're talking about Total Biscuit, not just because he was this, you know, very capable, very sharp reviewer that had so many different interconnecting webs of stories like this for his career, but also this entire story, as touching as it is, because it's inherently touching to me, it also is emphasized by the fact that reading about you on your website, you broke down very specifically into many details, and I'd encourage the listeners to go and read through that because it is well written. Just how the story goes between AI War to your second game, and it's what you called a commercial failure and the reception that you got. And I remember specifically you were describing that you were on vacation at the time of its release and having to deal with that while away from home, surrounded by family. And like at that point I could only imagine. And then when you mentioned Total Biscuit reaching out to you and everything, I'm like, there's so many interconnecting webs here that form a bigger story of not only who he was, but you know, how that affected you in any way, shape or form. And so, I mean, additionally, I'd love to,
that's why I wrote a lot of that out, because there are details that are burned into my brain that I'll never forget. And then there's lots of corroborating stuff that I just can't remember. And so I had to write it down. I was like, well, as long as I'm writing it down for me, I'm going to write it down at an interesting tempo, you know, to where it's just the highlights that other people would actually be interested in. And put that stuff online so that the context of those earlier years is maintained. I plan to do that for the kind of 2017 and after period, but I'm still too close to that to finish. People will still ask me about, like, hey, when's the next, like, chapter of that coming out? I'm like, I need time to, you know, it's kind of like doing a postmortem on a game. You know, I still need some distance before I feel comfortable writing those. Because I wrote most of what's on there about 2009 to 2016, I think, in 2020 or 2021. So having a gap there was helpful for clarity and knowing what to focus on in the bigger picture of time. You know, I would have said different things in 2016 and they would have been a lot less interesting.
Yeah. And I'd love to pivot to talking about your community. I mean, it sounds like John Bain wasn't the only one who was invested in the success of Arkham Games. I mean, he clearly, like I said, the story that you told was touching about the state that Arkham was in after the release of your second game, and then the way John Bain reached out. But as far as your larger community goes, you've hired from your community in the past. I've heard from reviews on Steam that you add in features based on community feedback or community mods from a Discord or personal server to into the game, into like the vanilla game.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, there's some people who have, you know, hung around since, you know, they're in and out, but I've hung around since, you know, that summer of 2009. And there's lots of people that join each year, you know, and sometimes it's an interesting thing because you never know when it's like the last time you're going to talk to somebody. And it's like, wait a second, I haven't talked to that person. I haven't seen their handle around. They were such a big part of life for a while. And then now it's been like 6 years since I last saw their handle. Dang, I hope they're okay. And then like, you know, 3 or 4 more years pass. And then they're like, hey, I like what you're doing on your new game. And here I am again. And it's like, oh my God, you know, and they're like, you remember me? I'm like, how would I not remember you? Like you were like giving me feedback, good and bad, you know, every, like honest feedback every day and like making suggestions and stuff like that. For, you know, like years, like how am I not gonna, and I, you know, whenever anybody gives a suggestion or something, I, you know, credit them in the release notes. And so like, how many times have I typed out your name in the release notes? Of course I remember, you know, I don't have any idea what gender you are, what you look like, where you live, anything, but I know your handle and, you know, that's, and, you know, your voice, how you present yourself and talk. And that's all I need to know, really. Yeah. Like even with Heart of the Machine, I mean, it's not, I mean, it's still in early access, right? So, there are people who, and even before it went to early access, there were testers who would, you know, hey, I've written this thing, you know, you can use it if you want to, or hey, I've coded up this thing, you know, and, you know, some developers are, you know, as long as you have permission from them, like when they're like, hey, I'll absolutely use it, you know, then that's one thing. Big developers like can get touchy if you're the multi-million or, you know, $500 million company or something, and you're taking work for free, like that can be like, that can get damaging pretty quickly. But for good another example of this, but with a much higher profile game than me, look at Factorio. They're doing the exact same thing. There's a certain dedicated group of modders who have full source code access to Factorio, and they make some improvements that the developers are like, yep, we'll take that to the actual game, that's fine. And they make other stuff that just goes to mods. And it's up to the developers what they are and are not going to pull into the main game. That's the line I draw as well. I, like I said, I spent a long time modding other people's games. And if, you know, various of those companies would have let me get into the code and make improvements, you know, that they reviewed or otherwise, absolutely I would have done it. You know, like, or if they would take, if they thought one of my little story arcs or whatever, or like a zone that I created in a level editor or something was good enough to include, my God, I would have given it. It wasn't about like money or something, right? It was about just like, I made this thing because I want people to see it. And it was me practicing and it was me enjoying myself as part of me, as part of my hobby, you know? And so I kind of recognize that versus I think some developers or like, I only know this is the thing you do for money. So I don't understand these people who do it for free. Like, are they a threat? Are they like trying to, you know, is this like a race to the bottom on salaries? Is that what this is? Is this like, no, this is their hobby. Like, chill out. It's fine, really. Like, they don't necessarily want your job, and they probably also have a good job of something else. Like, some of the contributors just stuff will say things in private. Yeah, I'm actually a patent lawyer, you know, that I do this in my spare time. Like, okay, you know, oh yeah, I work at, you know, Google, and I'm actually a software engineer there, but I like am bored in my spare time because of the projects I work on. Where I'm like, oh, all right, you know, like you make more than I do probably, you know. And it's you know, and there's other people who are just like, yeah, I'm, you know, physically disabled and I live at home with my parents and I can't work and I love doing this. And, you know, that's, you know, like, so it's like all over the place where people's stories come from. And, you know, the other thing is authorship. If this is your first game ever, you're just making your very first game. You're an indie developer. It's your baby. You want it to be exactly yours, and you want to show off how smart you are, and you want to make sure that everyone is really clear that it's you. You did this without any help. And then you're going to turn down all offers of help, right? Or not properly credit people or something. And that fades. And I never really had that from the start, largely because, as I said, with AI War, I thought I was working on a side project. I had my real project, and then this was just a little thing I was going to do for like 6 months, and it turned into 9 months, and then it was like, all right, well, this is actually the launch of a career. Okay. But I never was precious about it because, well, I'd made other games before that too. I just hadn't published them. So they weren't good. They were okay. But, so a lot of that, selfishness I had gotten out of my system as a modder when I was in my teens and early 20s. And I was like 27 when I started Arkin, I think. And so, yeah, 27. So, you know, it was, I was kind of past all that versus a lot of the strong personalities, without naming any names, from the, as I referred to it, like gold and silver age, there have a very strong sense of ownership of what they're doing. And they don't want to share the limelight at all because I think they're afraid that their auteur status is going to be challenged if they do. And I don't know whether I'm an auteur or not. I think a lot of people would say yes, and other people would say, who are you talking about? And it ultimately, it doesn't matter. You know what I mean? Because many brains are better than one in the same sense that many hands make light work. And it delights me when I see the interactions of some other things that some other people have created. And I don't feel diminished in any way by that or threatened by it or something like that, you know? And they're not like secretly hoping to get hired or something. Cause I make it really clear, like, you know, I don't have the budget for that right now. Yes, I have hired from, I've hired, I don't know, 5 or 6 different people, and it led to full-time jobs for half a decade in a couple of cases, you know? And they were paid very well, but that was also a different market at that point. And, so, you know, I think as long as you're upfront with people and they're clear on, you know, what to expect or not to expect, then, it can work really well. And, you know, the average legal department's going to have a cow about that, and that's fine. I don't have a legal department. I've, you know, there's, you know, so I'm like, it's cool. It's fine.
Because you've mentioned in the past about how you've always wanted to control every aspect of your projects. And I think that's changed. And recently you've mentioned hiring contractors and bringing people in and community input. How has handing parts of the development off to others influenced the way you lead the projects?
There's different ways you can look at control, right? You can look at saying, hey, there's a minimum bar of quality. I'm not going to put just some random thing in that's, you know, a joke or low quality, because I feel guilty because somebody did it. They gave it to me, or they've done some other favors in the past, like fix some bugs or something. And now they want this thing in and I don't think it's good enough. You know, I'm going to be very respectful of them in the same way that they're respectful of me when they give criticism. But I'm going to say, you know, this doesn't fit with the vision that I have for the game, but I'm happy to have it as a mod. You know, you're welcome to make mods. And that, you know, there's all sorts of silly mods or stuff that, you know, breaks copyrights in Star Trek or whatever, right? And it's like, you know, I'm a company. I can't do that. But mods certainly can. And overall, that's the only real thing that I feel like control. Like when I was early in my career, well, before my career, honestly, it comes from a place of insecurity, right? I was a teenager. I was an early 20 something. I was not secure in the fact of, ooh, look how smart I am. You know what I mean? Like you want to show off how smart you are, right? And if you're creative and it's your first or second or whatever thing, then you're going to be a little precious about it. And you're going to be like, oh my God, you know, like I need everybody to see how smart I am and recognize me in some way. This is, Heart of the Machine is, I think, my 12th game. It's like my 26th thing on Steam when you count DLCs and stuff. And, you know, and I had another four projects or something that got partway through along to like prototyping or whatnot. And they were like, yeah, this isn't going to be good. Let's get rid of it, you know. And then all the stuff that I did before even, you know, starting this profession just as a hobby, you know, the mod stuff that I did, some of which was public, some of which was not. And it's like, you get over it. You get over yourself. And it's like, you just want to see the project be a good version of what you have in mind. And there's overall two kinds of feedback that people give, or suggestions as well. There's stuff that is aimed at making whatever it is you're doing a better version of what it is. That's great feedback to listen to and take. There's other feedback, which is aimed at changing it into something else. I liked the idea of what you're proposing, like as a game, but then I played it and I hate what you did. What if we change it into this totally other game via the suggestions I am now making to you? That is feedback that shouldn't be out of hand completely ignored, because there's some nuggets in that anyway a lot of times. But ultimately, it's not like, well, yeah, all the people who like the game are going to be kind of pissed if we like change it. It's like, oh, Warframe, you know, wouldn't it be better if it was like an offline game instead of a, you know, like whatever, right? Like there's going to be stuff like that where it's just like, it would be so much more fun if you took away this thing that's central to the identity of the game. And it's like, I understand that you're saying that and that you were hoping this was a game of that sort, but, you know. And a lot of my game ideas for my own stuff, I keep a log of stuff. Every time when I think a game that I'm excited about some game, I think it's one thing, and I play it, and I'm like, oh, I write down what I thought it was, not what it actually was. I'm like, I might do that later, because the idea that was in my head, at least, was something I thought was more interesting than what they produced. So I'm kind of like, you can take that too. Like, if you ever make a game, then make what you thought I was making. Like, it's fine, you know? So it all just comes down to kind of moderation and balance, right? You don't want to have, unrestricted, just crazy changes happening. That makes everyone unhappy, especially the players. And it gives a real schizophrenic vibe to, the game, because it doesn't have any, it's not saying anything. It doesn't have any sense of authorship, etc. If somebody can't write in the voice of the game, then if they give an idea, then I'll say, I'll take it, but I'm going to rewrite this with permission, right? Like, I'm going to write it in the voice of the game, whatever game this is, because it's got to tonally match. Otherwise, it's like, you run into problems. And so, yeah, it all comes down to just being good at compromising, being able to say no, and not being too full of yourself and not being too insecure, because most people who are full of themselves are just insecure, you know, and they'll grow out of it. If they're given a chance to get through three or four projects, they'll grow out of it. Usually there are exceptions. very notably and publicly so, but most of them grow out of it.
Well, we are coming up on the end of this episode here, so I'll start wrapping up. But Chris, I did want to ask you two more quick questions. Firstly, can you tell our listeners what is the Arkanverse?
Right. So that is a shared universe, it's technically a multiverse. And yeah, I know you're going to roll your eyes, but I did it well before the MCU is a thing. But yeah, back in 2009, 2010, it seemed really cool to have an overarching universe that games would fit into. And the MCU wasn't a thing yet, so that wasn't like a, you know, like a cliche. And, you know, certainly Spider-Man 3 or the new one, you know, or if it was Doctor Strange in the Multiverse of Madness, when they started going into multiverses, I was like, no, please stop. Like, I've been doing this since like 2014 and now you're making it a thing that people are mad about. But, yeah, it's basically just a shared, collection of games that are set at different points of time. And the cool thing about that is that they can all have the same physical rules, right? So when it's all sci-fi and it's like, okay, cloaking works this way in this universe, like Star Trek, right? So it's like, you know, but we're going to have a completely different game and a completely different genre, completely different tone. It's in Andromeda this time instead of being in, you know, the Milky Way, and it doesn't even involve humans or whatever, right? And then it's like, all right, but this is how, like, some of the more sci-fi level of physics work, you know, where you have to pick, like, is there FTL? What does it work like? That sort of stuff, right? And so one of the reasons why I made it into a multiverse was because players were asking, what's canon? And I didn't like the idea. So, right, like in AI War, all of them, there's a bunch of different factions you can add in. And it's like, is it canon that it's just you in a cage match versus the AIs? Or if there's some alien factions in there, is that the canon? Is it canon? You know, like, you know, some people like playing with like the Spire aliens so much they don't play any other way. Are all their games non-canonical? Like, and so I was like, you know what? It makes a lot more sense if all of them are canonical. These are, you know, every game you play is a different part of the multiverse. And this one, the Spire were there. And this other one, they weren't. And this one, the Nainzel were around, you know? And so that led to some interesting things where in like AI War 2, the Zenith are like a ancient dead race. And it's kind of a little cliche in sci-fi, right? But it's, you know, you got the ancient alien artifacts from a few billion years and so forth before. The interesting twist with this one is that they're in none of the universes that humans are in as a living species, because if they didn't die, then they would have harvested Earth back when it was just microbes and we just wouldn't be around. And so our existence is predicated on the fact that they got beaten out at some other part. And so they're the one race that can actually travel across from a different universe where, so to them, when they come through from a different universe and they're like, oh my God, we died out 2 billion years ago here. It's a post-apocalyptic wasteland to us, to them rather. And it's just our normal universe. And we're like, yeah, we don't exist in anyone that, that you do, because our common ancestor microbe, you scrubbed off the planet when you just harvested it for minerals or whatever, you know, it would have been like 2 to 3 billion years back. And so that was a fun thing. And then, you know, Heart of the Machine started leaning even harder into the multiverse stuff with how it handles time travel. And I'm an enormous fan of time travel fiction of all sorts. And Chrono Trigger is one of my two favorite games. The Final Fantasy VI is the other. And Silent Hill 2 is a close third. But anyway, and I love different time travel systems. So this idea let me work in time travel in such a way that it's both novel, but also logically consistent, but not like, well, you know, Back to the Future, I love it, but it's not logically consistent in some various ways. And a lot of other time travel. That's the thing, is when you're writing a story or like a movie or whatever, you get to show whatever the parts are that you want, and the viewer, reader, whatever, doesn't get to like go and poke holes in all the edges. They can't like walk over the sand dunes and see the skybox, you know? But like, if you tried to make the Back to the Future rules in a game, like that doesn't really work because all the player quickly pokes holes in that. So you have to establish rules that can work in a game, which is a lot harder to do than writing, I've discovered, than writing something like Chrono Trigger works more like a book because it's all exactly pre-made. But when you've got any sort of like real agency and branching, it becomes you have to get stricter than a lot of fiction is with time travel. So that's really what the Arkhamverse is all about. It's just a kind of shared physical laws and how those relate. And you know, you don't have to know anything about, unlike the MCU, there's not a connected story between them particularly, because there's usually great distances in either time or space, or both. The protagonist from The Last Federation is also the protagonist of Starward Rogue, which is a completely different genre. It's an Isaac-like, as mentioned earlier, and that is set near the heat death of the universe, as that guy is an immortal and is still wandering around, and he finds a weird labyrinth and starts exploring it. And his time way back in Andromeda, which probably doesn't exist anymore because it's past the point where all the stars in Andromeda would have burned out for the most part, is like a distant memory. And that's really neat to be able to have a character like that recur. That's, I think, the only recurring actual character, and it's only because it's this immortal hydra type. He's a hydral is his race, but he's like a hydra basically. And so, you know, he's in part of the conceit of Starward Rogue is he basically like cuts off one of his heads, puts it in a mech, sends it into this weird artifact that he's found sticking out of the side of a star. And then it, you know, he finds out what happens to it through like radio telemetry. And then, you know, head regrows, cut off another one, send it in. So he's never really at risk, but he's exploring in that way, in a way that, you know, as humans, we can't, like short of being like Mickey 7 or whatever. Mickey 17, the movie, I guess. The book is much better.
Well, then the last question here to wrap us up is kind of a loaded statement. So your newest game, Heart of the Machine, is currently, it came out this year, earlier this year. It's sitting at very positive as of the recording of this on Steam. It's, yep. From what I have told, been able to see so far, it's one of your most reviewed games across the board. I think it looks incredibly intriguing. I'm actually really excited to get my hands on it. It's, as of the recording and release of this episode, I don't think it'll have been on sale or anything, but Hooded Horse is currently doing a lot of promotion on Steam. So, them being the publisher of this game is really exciting. Where can people listening to this episode find and buy Heart of the Machine?
So that's on, Steam and GOG as well. And, Epic Games Store as well. There are also a variety of key reseller type sites like Humble and ones like that that have sales routinely. So if somebody wants to catch it when it's on discount, then they could probably Nuvem and MUVE probably will have it, and Humble Store we'll probably also have it on discount at the time that looking around. Gamesporium might also, and Haybox might also, depending on when they look. So there's a lot of places, and some of those are focused on specific countries. But yeah.
The links to the Steam page and the GOG page for Half the Machine will be in the description of this episode for our listeners to head over and buy it. I already have. And then I flew off on holiday, but it's my next to play game.
Nice. Well, there's a big, at the time of recording, there's another big update that's coming out tonight, actually. But so it'll be well out by the time update 25 will be out by the time of this airs. And I think this is, Well, this feels like a capstone of my career so far in a lot of ways. It pulls together all the things that I love most. It's dense to get into. That's true of every game I've ever made for them. Not all of them. That's true of most games I've ever made. But, you know, you have to be up for some reading with it. And, you know, it's really gratifying to see that a lot of like the reviews, you know, have like 70 to 100 plus hours in it already, you know, and, the game pulls, there's a lot of stuff where if you're like 10 or 20 hours in, it's kind of like, oh yeah, you haven't even seen some of like the major twists yet, like where mechanically it like suddenly explodes and you're just like, wait, it does what now? I heard there was time travel. I haven't seen any time travel in like 20 hours later. It's like, oh, now there's time travel. All right. So like it's big. You know, people don't need to spend 100 hours with it, but, you know, it's ambitious.
Well, Chris, it has been so lovely to talk to you actually today and hear your insight into your number of games you've released on platforms across the years. So thank you so much for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me. Appreciate it.
Well, all right, everybody. Thank you for listening. Please go check out Chris's games on all platforms under Arkin Games LLC. This has been Critical Moves, and if anybody wants to become involved with the podcast or continue listening, we release every Friday on YouTube and streaming platforms where you can find your podcasts. If you'd like to get involved with the community of Critical Moves or have some discussions with us on the team or you know, suggest something for a future episode, please find us on our website, criticalmovespodcast.com, with hyperlinks to the Discord, the forum page, and, you know, the rest of the stuff you'll find there about the team. So thank you so much for joining, everybody. Have a good one.